It's time for another Steve Dale Petcast, sponsored by Zymox. Veterinarian recommended, pet parent trusted for resolving pets' ear, skin, and oral conditions for over 25 years. Now, here's Steve Dale.
Welcome to another WGN Radio Petcast. I am Steve Dale, and so lucky to talk to the people I have an opportunity to talk with, including this guy who's authored so many books, including the authoritative books, if you will, on dog training, particularly involving puppies. This book is called Barking Up the Right Tree, The Science and Practice of Positive Dog Training. His name is Dr. Ian Dunbar, who began serious dog training. He is the guy who decades ago said, we are training our dogs way too late and we're not socializing them as we should, which is something he writes about in this book. We're still not doing it as we should. We'll talk about that. First of all, Dr. Dunbar, how are you?
I'm very well. I mean, it's early for me. I'm having my coffee, but I think my brain is working. Anyway, great to chat to you again, Steve. What was it, just last week?
Right. We did something for WGN Radio and for the pet show that I host on Sunday mornings. And the reason, in part, why you're back is because I thought, I want to discuss something you said further having to do with Fear Free. Now, Fear Free, for those who don't know, is an initiative that began with veterinary professionals, technicians, and veterinarians to minimize fear, anxiety, and stress in our dogs and cats and any species that goes to the veterinarian. And it seemed as though, by listening to what you said, you clearly weren't a fan. But I don't know, and you'll tell me, whether that is the impression you truly want to leave us with.
Absolutely not. I just went back and listened to the interview, which, by the way, was a very good interview. It was really well done with a lot of incredible information in it. And what I said was, I'm not criticizing Fear Free. I love it. I've been doing it in my whole career, teaching vets, here's how you handle a puppy from the first visit to your vet clinic, so that he just loves coming to the vet clinic. What I said is, I just listened to my own words, I was really upset that now we have to teach veterinarians fear-free handling. And there's two parts to that. One is, I learned it naturally because I grew up on a farm, and you don't bully a cow. I mean, he'll just step on your foot and you can't move for 10 minutes. So there's that now we have a different demographic of vets. When I went to college, every single person, apart from one, was male, son of a veterinarian or son of a farmer. The other person was a woman, the daughter of a veterinarian. When I left vet college, 85% were women coming from cities. So now, all of a sudden, we had to teach this new topic, animal behavior, handling skills and such, because it was all very physical. So if we expand from fear-free, I feel the same about having to deal with, say, dog-dog reactivity. We didn't have it 20 years ago when all dogs were going to off-leash puppy classes, so they learned the social savvy to deal with dogs they don't know that may not have the same amount of socialization with other dogs. I hate the fact we have to deal with separation anxiety. All of these problems are so easily prevented in puppyhood. And then, you know, we go off. I think we always... So I was not criticizing Fear Free. A lot of people think I don't like shaping. No! I promoted the very first seminar when Karen Pryor first used a clicker to train dogs, and Gary Wilkes did all the training. No one signed up for it, you know, puppy work. So I said, oh, I'll promote it. I said, here is the pain-free alternative to teaching a force retrieve. There's no need to hurt a dog, especially a retriever, to teach it to retrieve. You just shape the behavior.
Well, there's
so
a lot... There's
very specific functions. And, you know, I think people get a knee-jerk reaction to what I say. And rather than asking a question, they say, oh, he doesn't like that. No, I love it. We shouldn't have the need for it. We are totally failing dogs and people. I want to talk solutions. How do we prevent this? And I now think, having worked with pet professions, dog professions, cat professions, for 50-odd years, I think the only way to change things is by telling the people, prospective puppy buyers, prospective adopters, you have a choice. So for a puppy, you can buy one that's house-trained, chew-toy-trained, manners-trained, and it's likely to live to a ripe old age. Or you can buy one that's not house-trained. It will chew your house apart. It barks all the time, and it's likely to die way before its time. Your choice. So buyer, adopter, beware.
Check. Well,
because we tend to think, just as we think all professionals are the same, they're not. Every professional is different. But we also think all dogs are the same. They're all going to grow up the same. No. The single biggest variable in a dog's behavior and temperament was whether it was socialized and trained as a neonate and then a very young puppy in the kennel and the first month in the home. Right, I've said my speech. There we go.
All right. So there's a lot to unpack there, more than we even have time to do, probably. So let's define our terms. Socialization, that term has been bantied about now for years. What exactly is that, and how do we socialize our puppies?
Well, there's two major species we want to socialize them with, people and dogs. The dogs, they get a lot in the litter. And it's basically being with, socializing with, playing with, and seeing a wide variety of that species, dogs or human. But then we have to put it on hold the first month the dog's at home until he's had his shots. But the people stuff, no. We can safely socialize puppies to people as neonates. You see, they can't hear or see, but they can feel and smell. And as I said in the WGN, interview, that nearly all of the 13 most common subliminal bite stimuli, reasons for a dog to bite, can all be desensitized in neonates because they can feel. That's seven of them, touching the ears, the paws, the muzzle, the rear end, the ghoulies, clipping the neck, all that. And then different people. The dog knows this person's a stranger. It can smell them. When we're like a two-week-old neonate. And then as soon as their eyes open, let's now bring these people to the house. Don't take the puppy to the people. Bring the people to the house. Have enormous parties for the puppy. Make sure the people you leave their outdoor shoes outside to protect infection from, infected soil they've trodden in. They don't track it in the house. But now they handle the puppy all over. They give, hand feed it kibble. They train the puppy, come sit. And what is most important is that we expose puppies early on to unfamiliar people, especially men and children. Because owners get duped when they get their puppy. The first month at home, they complain to me, oh, good Lord, he's overly confident. He's overly friendly. And I say that's because you're just viewing your puppy in the familiarity of your home with familiar people doing familiar things. You must expose your puppy to unfamiliar people so the unfamiliar becomes the familiar of adolescence. Otherwise, it is absolutely normal behavioral development for puppies to become increasingly wary and then scared and then reactive towards the unfamiliar during adolescence. So you see, it's an adolescent onset problem, and they're looking at their young puppy, and they think, so far, so good. It's like someone who jumps off a 20-story building, and they hear him going past the fifth floor saying, so far, so good. And then they suddenly get this problem. They're walking the dog, and he gets into a scrap. Or he's growling at their niece, and they go, oh, my God, we got a problem. Yep, quite predictable, on cue, And so...
So by Dr. Dunbar, by adolescence, let's define what that is. And I suppose it's different in a Chihuahua compared to a Great Dane, but approximately.
I define most things by situation in development. I don't use the old Scott and Fuller thing because it's a little woolly, other than taking the concept that socialization should happen very early, before 8 weeks or before 12 weeks. So I define development into birth, that's a big change, to 8 weeks when they change from usually the breeder's kennel to the home. The first month at home, because it's so special, there's so much to do, this is when we prevent dog-dog reactivity, fear of people, and separation anxiety if we raise the puppy right in that first month. But then there's a massive behavior change at 18 weeks. You know, a little female puppy goes to bed, a female puppy, and she wakes up a bitch. The transition into adolescence is abrupt. And that's why we must do all our socialization before that. How long does it last? Oh, 2 years in little dogs, 3 years in big dogs. And so a lot of, say, breeders, they say, oh, my puppy, and they're talking about an eight-month-old adolescent. It's not a puppy. And so the definition of a puppy is I can bring them into puppy classes and let them off leash together, and we're not going to have any damage. After 120,000 puppies and 42 years of puppy training, we've never had one puppy hurt another. Yet they're all off leash and playing and scuffling and coming when called from the play session. You know? And so, yeah, the Scott and Fuller gave us a good template. But the notion that the critical period of socialization is, say, 3 weeks to 13 weeks, you know, development isn't that way. It's like Dr. Spock and babies. They don't all talk on the same day of their life, you know. Some don't talk for 3 years, others are talking early. But there are huge transitions, birth, changing homes, and from puppyhood into adolescence.
The only Spock I know is from Star Trek. And I want to define Scott and Fuller. You mentioned their names. They are researchers that harken back to the, 1960s, even early 60s, even earlier than that.
1940s.
Yeah, yeah.
Pearl Harbor, Maine in the 40s and 50s. Yeah.
And they are the ones that said, hey, we need to socialize our puppies first and define what that, I think they called a critical period of socialization. I want to come back and talk to you about separation anxiety. You mentioned twice it can be prevented. What? We're going to learn.
Wait.
We're going to learn. I've got to do my radio, or in this case, petcast tease. We're going to learn what that's all about, how you might be able to easily do that when we come back with Dr. Ian Dunbar, author of Barking Up the Right Tree, The Science and Practice of Positive Dog Training.
Hello, friends. Steve Dale here. Is your pet caught in the endless cycle of itch, scratch, rub, and chew? Fear not! Zymox's enzyme-based skin and ear products calm and soothe irritated skin or red infected ears. For over 25 years, Zymox has been the go-to for clean, healthy ears and itch-free skin. Available on Amazon, Chewy, Petco, PetSmart, and local veterinarians. Your pet's comfort is just a step away.
He's barking up the right tree, Dr. Ian Dunbar. That's the name of the book. The Science and Practice of Positive Dog Training. And you mentioned not once but twice the idea of prevention for separation anxiety. Now, that's a topic I talk about at veterinary meetings, actually, and elsewhere. So tell me what I should be saying about prevention, because, of course, if prevented, we don't have to deal with the treating it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people will criticize me. You're always talking about prevention and puppies. Why? And I say, because every single shelter dog was once a puppy just begging for an education, especially how to live in our crazy world and how to enjoy being left at home alone, how to amuse itself. So basically, you know, all this information is in two little books, which I have made available for free on all of our websites for 20 years. Okay, 20 years they've been available for free. So now I'm spending one more year pushing this program. We call it the Free Pup Books Program. So it's a simple link, dunbar.info/freepupbooks. And this explains all of the preventive measures. So to separation anxiety, we must from the start get the puppy used to little short quiet moments on its own. You know, a lot of people will have the puppy off leash and with them always. And this is a setting up a precedent. So, of course, the puppy's going to freak out when it's Monday and you go to work or the kids go back to school. So we train the puppy to enjoy being on its own. And this goes along with chew toy training it, which is an auto-shaping process, meaning you set up for the puppy to train himself. You train the puppy not to develop a barking habit, and you teach it to pee on cue. So basically, for the first month, for the most part, the puppy lives in a crate. You let him out every hour on the hour. So the first problem we're going to have is he doesn't like the crate. So we play crate games, and I love them. I open the crate, and we're nice, comfy bed in there. I toss a treat in. Puppy goes in, gets it, comes out. I toss another treat in. This is how he's going to eat today. There's no food bowl. I'm going to toss the food bit by bit in his crate so he gets used to running in there. Then I'm going to put three bits of food. I'm going to let the puppy sniff them, put them in the crate, shut the crate door with the puppy outside. It's just hilarious. The puppy's like, hey, what you done? There's treats in the crate. I can't get in. And I say, oh, do you want to go in your crate? I open the door. Puppy goes in. I close the door. Puppy eats the treats. And I open the door. So I'll do this for about 15 minutes until the puppy goes in the crate, whereupon I'll give him a Kong stuffed with dry kibble. So when he noses it, it comes out, which reinforces him for nosing it. So he knows it more. So he's learning how to play with his Kong. As he gets older, I will soak the kibble and stuff the kibble mush in there with a couple of little treats at the bottom, like Ziwi Peak or something. And then I will stuff it with kibble mush and freeze them. So now we got the puppy on an hourly schedule. We say, hey, do you want to go in your crate? And he runs in there because he's going to get a new stuffed Kong. All of his food for his first month is fed only in Kongs. We want to turn him into... So he loves going in his crate and playing with it. And as he's playing, what's he doing? Well, he's lying down and he's not barking. Whoa. Every bit of food that comes out automatically, every bit of food the puppy extricates, reinforces the puppy for lying down quietly and calmly. Oh, wow. And enjoying his crate. Okay, our alarm goes off 1 hour later. We say, hey, puppy, you want to go outside? And I get him to sit first. Even he's 8 weeks old, first day I've had him. Sit before I open the crate, then I snap on the leash, and I run to his doggy toilet and stand still. I will bet anyone $100 this puppy will pee before 10 seconds. I'll bet them $200 he'll pee before 20 seconds. So I keep saying, go pee, go pee, go, oh, good dog, good dog, good, gentle praise. I don't want to interrupt him. Good boy, here's a treat, there's a treat, there's another treat. And it's like I said on the last interview, the puppy says, why didn't you tell me that before? I just peed all over the kennel. You know, I didn't know this was a precious commodity and I could cash it in for treats. Then we let the puppy off leash in the house because he's empty. And we train him. Come here, sit. Come here, sit. Come here, sit. Come here, sit down, sit. Stand down, stand. We're getting these basics down. And then we say, come and sit and let him sniff the food, but don't give it. We count to three. Good dog one, good dog two, good dog three. And give him the food. We've now got a tum sit and a 3 second sit stay. Now we delay giving the food longer and longer. Getting the pup to do these calm, focus, watch me sit stays. So we do that 5 minutes, 10 minutes or longer. It's up to you. And then back in the crate again with another stuffed Kong, we set our timer for 1 hour, and that's how he lives.
You know,
and we have two little tricky moments there, which is the first night, which we probably don't have time to discuss, or the crate games, you know, to get him used to the crate. But you've prevented so many problems there because you've given the pup the confidence to amuse himself on his own to the point where he enjoys it. Now, month by month, you can increase his freedom. Like, I have two dogs here at the moment, and I'm looking after someone. I've shut the door behind me so they don't push the phone and things like that and disconnect us. But they're in any room of the house because they're trained. Their choice. And so we can give the animal more and more freedom. Sadly, what most people do is they have total freedom and total contact with them up front, and then they progressively restrict the dog to one room, then a basement, then the backyard, and then we know what happens then.
I think that
the relationship.
I think that last sentence is actually the most important sentence, that we kind of sometimes get it backwards and that we give them too much freedom at the beginning and then we go the other way, which is difficult for the dog to sometimes understand. Let me ask you the other side of the coin here, and we at this point have limited time, but there are some who say that separation anxiety can have a genetic predisposition. Does this always work, what you're suggesting?
Yeah, look, that sort of, I hate that sort of yes, but statement. It's irrelevant. Here's the deal, the difference between genes and environment. You're looking at a pair of dogs, and then, whoa, they start mating. And then the male gets off after a while, and little sperm is shooting up, and all of a sudden, a sperm has gone into an egg. You know what? You now have a zygote. The gene team has made its play. Let's hope the breeder chose these two dogs very carefully, that all of their forebears live to be at least 10, preferably 15 or 17. Because there's nothing you can do about genetics now bar genetic engineering. Everything now depends on behavior and training. So do you see now why I'm such a out in left field proponent of socialization, training, and prevention? There's nothing else we can do. I'm fed up with these genetic arguments. If you've got a genetic argument, then think about it before you breed the two dogs. Why are you breeding those dogs when you look back in their pedigree and every single male dog was less than 3 years old?
But statistically,
you're breeding unproven males.
Indeed, but Dr. Dunbar, statistically, about half or more today of dogs are mixed breed dogs, and their lineage is unknown greatly. The most common dog in America, according to the American Kennel Club, is the French Bulldog. But in reality, the most common dog in America is a dog that we look at and call a pit bull. They're mixed-breed dogs in truth, but that's what they have, this blocky head and big shoulders and all the rest. So we're not talking always anymore, in fact, less and less and less, about that Scottish Terrier or a Border Collie or whatever the purebred dog is. And among the purebred dogs, although I don't view them as purebred myself, we've got all the doodles and all the rest of the so-called designer dogs as well. And they're really just mixed breed dogs at this point, I think.
Yeah, so same applies. Once you have a zygote, why are we talking about genes? All you can do is change the behavior with training. Give the dog the gift of confidence. Give the dog the gift of being calm on cue. I don't want to inhibit dogs from playing and acting like idiots. I put acting like an idiot on cue. Get up and we jump around and we bark and then I say, settle down. I give the dogs bark-a-thons when I'm driving in the car. I want the dog to be a dog, but I also want the owner to have the mastery of the skill to say, shush, settle. And the dog does it. Because we split life into times when you can totally be a dog and times when you have to fit in with, human living. But the same applies. Why are we even talking about genetics? With the one exception, the doodly type dog, the designer dogs, as you called them, if this is a first cross between two very dissimilar gene stocks, two different breeds, it's likely to be far healthier than a regular old mongrel, and much healthier than the two purebreds. I mean, this is what we call hybrid vigor. And so that does make sense, that we cross purebreds. And so when you look at life expectancies, mongrels do live longer than purebred dogs, and some purebred dogs now are dying unbelievably young. I mean, Omaha, my first Malamute, died at 5.
Oh.
Zuzu, the love of my life, died at 8. This is criminal.
Yeah,
I should have been enjoying both those dogs when they were 17 years old. They did, this is the crazy thing. The farmers did it with cows. How they changed cows in, like, my lifetime is unbelievable. Our life expectancy doubled in 100 years. Dogs has decreased. We've got to do something about it, and that's why I say we let owners know they have a choice. What would you like? A dog that will probably be dead with big veterinary bills at 5 or 7? Or do you want one that lives with you until all his whiskers are white and he's 17 years old and you have to help him up on the couch, but he can jump down on his own, and he can still pee and poop, so he's got a good lifestyle. I love old dogs, man. And I think to be deprived of that after a dog now knows you, it can read you, it does everything, you know, on time with your lifestyle. You go through life together, and then boom, 8 years old, it dies.
It's, yeah.
We got to change this.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And one example is of many examples, hemangiosarcoma happening, the golden retrievers at the age of 3 or 4. It is criminal, and the Morris Animal Foundation is working on that. But the fact that we've gotten to that point, or the BOAS issue in the brachiocephalic breeds, like the French bulldogs that we've bred to extremes. I mean, that's crazy. Let me ask you one more question, and then I'm out of time. One more question with a fast answer, because I think it's important. You've talked before about the best reward we can give, and certainly our love, certainly the best treat that individual dog likes. But you also talk about something that I think is really important, life rewards. Can you explain?
Oh, yeah. I mean, people just say, good dog, if you're lucky, some will go click, and then he gets the same old treat. And that's a good beginner reward because it works with every dog for a time period. But much better is I use primarily my two major rewards are let's go, the walk continues, go sniff, or go play. These are things the dogs want to do, so I put them on cue, and when I'm walking, dog on leash, every 25 yards, I just stop, which is the signal for the dog to automatically sit by my side, and then I say, good dog, let's go, the walk continues. So many people will let the dog engage in sniffing, play, and walking, and they never stop it. See, every time you stop it by asking the dog to sit, you can then restart it. That the walk resumes, the sniffs resume, the play resumes. So that's how to get really high reliability in a dog. And I would just add on one thing about change. The only way these things we've talked about today will change is through people like you, Steve, who talk about it on the radio, letting owners know they have a choice when they get a puppy. Don't think they're going to get this type of dog and it'll grow up like Lassie or Eddie. Was that Eddie's name on TV? I can't remember.
Yeah,
that.
From Frasier, the Jack Russell Terrier. But the thing is, the people adopt, which is wonderful, a five-year-old dog today or whatever that age is. That's great. I'm sure you'd agree with that, but there's no way to know that history, right?
Oh, of course there is. They should adopt from a shelter that has a full-blown open-paw type behavior and training program with at least 200-300 volunteers.
Yes.
So you ask these people and they'll say, well, actually, this dog is reacting to cats, or he doesn't like it when kids pass his cage. So the owner is informed when they adopt an animal. You know, half of our animals I've ever had, we've adopted, not just dogs, but other animals. But I know them back to front before I bring them home. Like, number one, how will my other dogs react to this? You know? And so we had a humane society, we won't mention its name, wouldn't let my dogs meet the dog. I wanted to save his life. He's going to be euthanized the next day in a no-kill shelter, you know? For supposedly biting an employee. Oh, God, he just nipped, you know? And so I just went to the director, said, look, this is not a good news bite, and I will go to the Chronicle. And he said, Ian, bring the dogs into my office. And that's where they met. And Ollie didn't really like Claude, but he didn't dislike him, so now Claude became our new pack member. But when we did a blind adoption and rescued Zuzu from up north, when we got her home, Dune just didn't like her. Hugo went ballistic. He screamed. He snapped. He growled. He hated this dog. She was really annoying. But like everyone, she stole all of our hearts. First Dune's, then Hugo's, and then mine. And then died at 8.
Oh.
We need to know they have a choice when you're buying a puppy or adopting a dog. And so do it wisely. This stuff is very easily searchable. And what I would love to see is now a database of breeders who are actively breeding for longevity, like I think Doberman Club now.
That would be nice. That would be nice. You know, but the American Kennel Club isn't necessarily enthusiastic about these sorts of things, which is a whole different conversation. I shouldn't have even said that because I don't want to lead you somewhere else, because talking to you, we can go on for hours, but unfortunately, we are out of time. But there's a lot in this book, Barking Up the Right Tree, The Science and Practice of Positive Dog Training. We'd only touched on a tiny portion of what's in this book by Dr. Ian Dunbar. Dr. Dunbar, what website can people go to learn more about you?
I would probably, DunbarAcademy.com. I would go straight into the free book funnel, because then you'll get to free courses, lots of other free stuff there, plus you'll get the free 1 month, you know, subscription for the whole website. Well, and so that is dunbar.info/freepupbooks.
Okay, I'll put a link in the description. Dr. Ian Dunbar, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
And next time, maybe have me back when we can talk about how do we get the kennel clubs around the world to change, because I think we can. It's in there for their benefit.
Okay, I'm just going to leave it there because we are out of time. Thank you, Dr. Dunbar.
All right. Thanks, Steve. It's fun. I'll finish my coffee now.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast from Steve Dale. Sponsored by Zymox. Veterinarian recommended, pet parent trusted for resolving pets' ear, skin, and oral conditions for over 25 years.